You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution to our P.O. Box, P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
Welcome to our Thanksgiving Weekend Letters Show 2012. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Fox News Election Night Turkey Pardon Power Panel, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Yeah, we figured out that it was actually election night on Fox when all the turkeys were pardoned.
Well, except one, maybe.
Well, maybe Romney.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love, you know, you can actually picture him sort of mentally in that Sarah Palin photo where she's standing in front of the turkey beheading devices.
Yes, right.
And in goes Romney. Romney who? Who? What? He was never here.
He was never here.
They're doing what I think used to be called on the assembly line, speed up, in the way that they unremember the past. It used to take them like 5 years to forget everything that they thought. And then it took them about 2 years. And now it's taking them a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
It took them a while to put on funny hats and pretend the Bush administration never happened. But 3 days after he lost, Mitt Romney is gone.
Yeah.
That election is gone. The endorsements are gone. All the people who said, you know, David Brooks wrote about how it's a good thing that he's a flip-flopping soulless automaton because that's just what this country needs. Okay, and now that's over. Now let's get on to the bright future of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
He just fucking disappeared. And everyone's disavowing knowledge of their actions, you know? It's just, I was never there, man.
Yeah.
I don't know nothing. Except, of course, you've used up your tri-corner hats and your Gadsden flags. So what do you dress up as now to pretend that you were never part of the Romney revolution? Who knows? But it will make for a very entertaining second inaugural. I am looking forward to the second inaugural address by Obama.
Yeah.
Man, talk Martin about speech writers under the fucking microscope. Yeah. You know, his will be compared to Lincoln's.
Yeah. And I hope that he talks about community organizing, motherfuckers.
That's right. You know what?
Because that's really what he needs to do. He needs to go back to his roots and say, we are a community. This is where we as a nation and as a society need to go. Here's how government can help. End of story.
And throw a little Key and Peele in there, you know?
Yeah. they were on last night on Ed Show. Yeah, I think it was Ed Show. No, Chris Matthews. We're recording this on Wednesday because it's the last day we have this week with a kid-free house.
And it's a early school release for at least one.
Yeah. And then the other one has to be rushed to a video game store. We're not going to talk about that.
Yes.
Because buy nothing year is...
Yeah.
This is buy nothing year for us pretty much. But the young man, the teenage boy, he organized it, didn't he?
He did.
He asked for gift cards for his birthday, which is in October, and he asked for gift cards for Christmas.
Yes.
And so he's going to get the platform thing that he wants as a combination of those two holidays. So
and he rolls out of bed in the morning and asks me, how do you open a business?
Because he wants more money for games. Yeah.
Well, first.
Very
first,
typical child.
Let me tell you how it's done in the real world. First, you take all your gift cards and give them to me, and I'm a consultant, so I will. I will
tell you. 30%.
I'll design your logo. I'll talk about your. We'll do trust falls. I'll talk to your staff about how they can, you know, radically re-engineer and diversify.
And then at the end of the week, you'll ask, "Who took my cheese?" And it turns out it was the consultant.
It was the consultant. Oh, it's like Mousetrap.
Technically, the consultant did it.
Yeah. And that's welcome to the big leagues, kid.
Yeah.
Thank you for the money.
This is our letter show.
Yeah.
And we're going to start with looking at both sides, Driftglass. We have to look at both sides because there's a big controversy.
There is.
Regarding our podcast and whether we cover David Brooks too much.
Yeah.
And so Maddie on Facebook, thank you, Maddie, for writing us. And I did respond to her on Facebook. She was responding to episode 152, which was the weekend immediately preceding the election.
Yes.
And why don't you read what Maddie had to say? Because I think she makes some good points.
Of course you do. You have to put up with me the other 23 hours a day when I'm not doing the podcast.
I do.
All right. Maddie on Facebook responds to episode 152 as follows. I know you guys just have a massive hate on for David Brooks, but I feel like this podcast should have been completely more focused on the election. Nobody cares about David Brooks. I know that you're doing a long-term narrative more focused on the media and its failures, but this week was way too important to waste on David Brooks.
And what I responded, you know, what David Brooks did that week was endorse Mitt Romney.
Yes.
And that's what we were talking about. And maybe we weren't emphatic enough about that we are really actually talking about David Brooks's endorsement of Mitt Romney and how craven it was. And that really was election related, in my personal opinion. I do think that she makes a good point in that anyone who has listened to more than four episodes of this podcast has heard your speech about David Brooks, the general speech about David Brooks.
Absolutely.
And I think it's probably good for us in future podcasts, if we're going to talk about David Brooks, to specifically talk about whatever column that week you're addressing.
Fair enough.
And that's worth it. But on the other hand, we got a snail mail letter from our dear friend Karen. And Karen said, and this was within the same month, she wrote, tell Driftglass that there can never be too much bashing of David Brooks. He deserves all the rancor that can be piled on him. I particularly despised him long before your show started, so it tickled me to hear someone else share my opinion of him.
Yes.
So, you know, it's a controversy, and I think it's an extreme position to say nobody cares about David Brooks because a million Chinese read him.
A billion.
Read him. Yeah. So.
Well, and he's a stand-in for lots of other people. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely true. He is working on a long-range project of completely rewriting conservative history.
Yeah. And let's read Richard's email because that relates to that.
And Richard writes via email, I agree with Driftglass that people like Brooks, McKinnon, etc., who have been wrong about everything, need to go into media exile for a long time. Maybe they could take themselves off the air and the opinion pages. Haven't they ever heard of self-deportation?
I love that email.
You kind of wonder about that.
That really is one of the stupidest ideas that came out of this election year.
Self-deportation.
Classic, stupid, bad idea. You wouldn't be able to do this because of copyright, but you know what would be a really funny book to write?
What?
And just cover it and market it just like it's a hagiography, but just make a little book called The Portable David Brooks. And just have these little quotes.
A little red book of David Brooks. Yeah. David Brooks in 2000. David Brooks.
You can't stop, Driftglass.
I can't. 2001. Competent conservatives, reactionary liberals. David Brooks writes in January of 2001, we seem to be entering a period of competent conservatism and reactionary liberalism. George W. Bush has put together a cabinet long on management experience and practical skills, but liberal commentators and activists, their imaginations aflame, seem to be caught in a time warp back in the days when Norman Lear still had hair. Because it's always fun to insult Norman Lear. Mm-hmm. I mean, and seriously, this is shit that is out there in print for anybody who wants to see it. And yet Mr. Brooks has leveraged his inexplicably impregnable job, the New York Times, which is the most influential paper in the country. Remember, David Brooks gets calls from Barack Obama. David Brooks's opinions are solicited by people who govern our country. And he has leveraged that into a cottage industry where he lectures at colleges. He goes to the Aspen Institute. He's on NPR all the time. He's on Meet the Press whenever he wants to be. And his opinion-making machine influences the opinions of millions of people in this country to believe shit that just ain't true every bit as much as Rush Limbaugh. Except there's an entire industry built around pushing back at Rush, and there ain't no such industry built on pushing back at David Brooks. And that's
because
why I do it.
Because of class
and money.
Yeah.
And because me and Charlie Pierce.
Yeah.
And Charlie Pierce is a little bit late to the party, if you ask me. Anyway, on to our letters.
Now, we want to say we have two letters that are really the meat of our podcast about whether or not to argue with conservatives on Facebook. And this This is, we had to kind of do this thematically. These are long emails. And I want to say my apologies to everyone else that wrote, because we can't, I have a stack of letters here that I really wanted to get to. And time is just not going to allow us to do it. But I want to say, too, that we are forming a community here. And I have to say, I'm writing to my mother today because I realized I have all this correspondence that I do with podcast listeners. And then my dad has to send me stamps. So I'll write to my mother. So, but it's fun because you go to the P.O. Box more than I do.
Yeah.
And you bring these letters home and I say, oh, we heard from David. Oh, we heard from John. Oh, we heard from Bob. Oh, look at this. It's a letter from Geek Hillbilly wrote us. And Peter in California wrote us. And Karen wrote us. And
from all over the world, actually.
All over the world. Lisa Ann wrote us. And just these lovely letters. And a lot of them are repeat correspondence. And, oh, I wonder what's up with David. I wonder, oh, that's a nice card he sent us. And so on and so forth. And we just love getting your letters. And I just want to say that. It's fun to be pen pals with all of you that write more than once. We love hearing from you. And now on to an email from William about arguing with conservatives on Facebook. And I think you and I have a different perspective on this a little bit.
Well,
so we'll get into a conversation about it, too.
My quick perspective at the top is I'm not on Facebook. I don't.
Oh, that's true.
I don't argue with people on Facebook. I love our page. I love the professional left presence on there. I love the fact that my wife is so technologically gifted and can type way faster than I can.
That's true.
And is a much more tolerant and decent human being than I will ever be. But I simply, the entire concept of Facebook makes my skin crawl.
Yeah.
It just is such a, it expects you to divest yourself of your privacy, your innermost thoughts, and that those things should be available on demand to anybody. Yeah. And I'm completely of the opposite opinion, which makes me a contrarian old fart, I suppose.
Well, and I think as an anonymous blogger, you really do have to kind of watch where you are. And Facebook does just strip you of any anonymity that you might have. And I have had people say, is this guy Driftglass? And I have to say, I swear to you, Driftglass, in two words, has a Facebook account so that he can look at pictures that someone sent him, that was the only way they were going to send them to him.
That was the only way, the only reason I signed up was a blogger friend of mine said, I have pictures on Facebook. Okay. Well, you have to sign up to Facebook. Okay. And ever since then, I've been getting friend requests, which I understand, but the idea of friending people is so creepy to me. That it's such a bastardization.
And on the other hand, I'm Francis Langham on Facebook, and you can friend me anytime and just come on over and, you know.
And I understand and respect people who have in matters of taste, as the Romans used to say, there can be no disagreement.
Yeah.
This is a matter of taste. But the social expectation that, well, of course you will be on Facebook and of course you will do these things is simply, I reject it, you know.
Well, and there are things, I mean, I am not a typical Facebook user. I posted one funny thing about you buying me knitting needles, and people were surprised that I had put a personal anecdote on, because I never publish pictures of the children. I mean, I just will not do that.
Yep.
And so my Facebook page is mostly activism, but there are no pictures of the children on my Facebook page, and there are no cute holiday pajami pictures, you know, opening presents. And most people use Facebook. God bless them. It's a great way to share pictures with grandparents and family members and let everybody know what you're doing. And I totally get that. Mm-hmm. But you and I have to balance the professional with the personal and recognize that as people whose opinions are out there, there are people that don't like those opinions and might have, you know, nasty things to say or harmful things to say or whatever.
Well, you know, come after me, but you come after my kids, you come after my family, you go after my paycheck.
Yeah.
And believe me, I've worked in organizations, when I started off being an anonymous blogger, I worked in organizations where I would have lost my job in two phone calls.
Yep.
And if you don't think that's real, then you don't live in the real world. And trust me when I tell you, it was a very, very democratic, liberal-leaning organization. It was not a conservative funhouse, but it was full of careerist people, people who were always about climbing the ladder over the bodies of other people, who absolutely wouldn't think twice about gutting whoever was ahead of them in line,
and using
whatever means necessary.
In any way, yeah.
And two phone calls, I would have been gone.
Yep.
Boom, just like that. And I'm keenly aware that that's the world I live in. I don't hide my opinions when I talk to anybody, but I don't like walking in with them printed on my T-shirt.
Yeah, and you don't like somebody having a bomb in their pocket that they're going to lob at you
because
of something you wrote.
Well, and it's more a matter of I want to – if I'm meeting a new person, if I'm dealing with a new organization, I'm absolutely willing to talk politics and culture and be very honest about my opinions. I don't hide them. But I don't walk in the door with that. The first thing I say is, hi, I'm a liberal.
Yeah.
And I'm a loud liberal, and here's what I think of conservatives. Any conservatives in the room? I don't – because you and I have talked about this.
Yes.
Which is at the local level, we are always trying to find ways to work constructively with people who we differ with.
Yeah.
Over school issues, over pothole issues. We both miss having a decent Republican conservative party to debate with.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that's our driving, but anyway, I've gotten far afield.
No, and I had a situation I did want to mention this past couple of weeks where someone that I'm in a meeting group with spewed a lot of talking points about a store, a big box store, actually. And it sounded like something to me that Snopes would have debunked. It had to do with Target, not to buzz market, but...
Yeah.
Had to do with Target, and Target is owned by the French, and they don't support veterans. So I'll never shop there because I don't defend Target. It's not my job to defend Target, but
no.
I knew Target wasn't owned by the French.
Yes.
I knew that. And so rather than – I didn't say anything at the meeting, but I went home and looked it up, and sure enough, there's this crazy email – viral thing out there that's screaming in all capital letters about don't shop at Target because they don't support veterans and they're owned by the French.
Yeah.
And several places, including veterans organizations, have debunked this crazy right-wing, and how it got started. They have some seeds of it available, but how it went to the French and all, who knows, Somebody had a grudge. And so I emailed everyone. I had emails for each person that was at this meeting. And I emailed them links not only to Snopes, which some people will discount, but to all these veterans organizations saying it wasn't true.
Yep.
I said, you might not believe Snopes, but I hope you'll believe the Vietnam Veterans Association of America. Hello. But at the end of the email, rather than saying... Because I know this person's a Fox News watching Republican who said this. I've talked to her about other things before. But instead of saying, see how wrong she was, I said, there are so many lies and misinformation on the internet. And if I ever say anything to you guys that you suspect isn't true, please do what I did and let me know, because I can be just as wrong as anybody else. And the enemy in that my email was misinformation.
Right.
I didn't make anybody feel bad. Didn't try to tell anybody they were jerks. I just said, there's so much out there that's just not true. If you hear me saying something and you think it's not true and you prove it's not, please tell everybody, because I want to be factually based also.
Yeah.
And then you don't make anybody feel bad. So.
Yeah.
This is our letter show, right?
Yeah. Well, but it's about how you debate, confront, argue,
within a community and try to build community. Yeah.
And depending on where you draw the boundaries of your community, and Facebook is big and largely anonymous or largely impersonal in that you can't actually throw a punch at somebody. And local means we both have the same problem in that there are too many goddamn cars going through the intersection. We need a stop sign.
Yeah.
And whether you're a Republican or Democrat, both our kids are at risk.
Yeah.
So can we agree that somebody, our tax dollars should go to a stop sign?
Right.
And
right,
so
right,
it really
right.
does depend on the context and what you want to get out of the argument. What yeah. is the object of engaging that person?
And that's
persuade
what
them.
This takes us right into William's email. So
yeah.
Let's
so read, let's go straight
go
into
read
it.
Into that. Yeah.
Email from William. Happy post-election cooling down period. Let me get the greetings out of the way first so we can get to the meat. I absolutely love your show, and I listen to it every week on my way to work. See, he works. Liberals have jobs.
Some of them do.
If that workplace paid me more than subsisted wages, I would help to subsidize your mission. Someday, but unfortunately not today. I apologize for that, but still thank you for being a source of education and entertainment for me on a weekly basis. You make working every Saturday a bit easier.
Let me just interrupt and remind everyone that the rule is if you can afford a espresso-based drink, we ask you to buy one for us. If
yeah.
you can't afford that,
yeah.
this is our gift to you.
Yeah, bag it.
Yeah.
Kick back and enjoy. You're not you feel yeah. no guilt at all.
Yep.
No, this is one of those things. We are that's our motto. And
yep.
we're sticking with it until NBC picks up our contract.
Not then, holding my breath
then
on
who
that
are
one.
You people? What? What? No. No. And you're with who now?
Yeah.
All right. So back to the letter. One of the things you folks have been discussing recently is the question of whether it is futile to argue with conservatives on the interwebs. I have an answer to that question. I have been arguing with right-wingers for over a decade on various message boards and more recently on Facebook, and my experience is that it is always fruitful to do so. Here's my reasoning. First, even though right-wingers seem to be rather impervious to fact and reason, every time they are assailed with facts, their ability to dismiss those facts crumbles a little more. You can't churn them completely, but you can create cracks in their obstinacy. Secondly, and more importantly, when you argue with right-wingers, you aren't arguing to convince them. You are arguing for the spectators. Very good point, William. They are the ones, regardless of political orientation, who can be swayed. There have been many times over the years where spectators have entered a thread to express that their mind was changed by arguments that I have made. And let me tell you, there is no thrill like having someone tell you that reading your arguments is, quote, like going to history class, only not boring, unquote. Very nice. For those who think of pursuing a career in internet debate, I offer the following tips. Be thorough every single time you post. Make sure you have your bases covered. Otherwise, you'll be playing catch up trying to respond to every argument against your position. Don't respond to every argument against your position. People playing just for points will throw everything they can at you to see what sticks. Don't fall for that trick. Don't lose your cool. If you have to calm down for a day or two, then do so. Once you lose your cool, you've lost the argument. Use humor to illustrate your points. Be clear and concise. Stay on topic and don't give in to temptation to respond to arguments designed to derail the argument.
Mm-hmm.
Following these tips will help to make your internet argument enjoyable and worthwhile. You probably aren't going to convince your right-wing opponent, but their friends and family will see the argument and read through it. Some of them will be convinced. When that happens, you will have done your job. Thank you for your attention. Keep on chopping wood and carrying water.
Oh, thank you, William.
Yeah.
And William sounds like he's put in his 10,000 hours, too.
Yep.
Of
yep.
just arguing with a goal in mind and being very clear about what is a waste of time and what isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I admire that about him. That's great. That's a good.
And learning
point.
What works and what doesn't.
Yeah, and you have if you're going to make a career out of this or a hobby, just remember you do have to put in the time. We talk, Driftglass and I talk a lot about putting in 10,000 hours, which is from a Malcolm Gladwell book.
Yeah.
That you put in once you have 10,000 hours of you've done something, you've mastered it. And
yeah.
whether it's knitting or writing or whatever you've done.
Playing the guitar. Or
playing the guitar.
Playing with the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah. Building computers. You've done it enough. You've put in the time to really make it work. And it sounds like William has done that. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to make a hobby out of arguing with people on Facebook, you know, remember you might not get it right all the time, and you do need to put in the hours. So on the other side, we have an email from Christine, and Christine very kindly allows me to mention that she is a blogger, and she blogs at a website called cookthestory.com. Cook the Story, where it's all about the story except when it's about the food. Now, there's that buzz marketing. Christine, it's a food blog that she runs, and I'm glad and grateful to her that she was willing to allow me to share that on the air. On Friday, a friend of mine sent me a Facebook message apologizing for unfriending me, but saying that she couldn't take all the political stuff anymore. This was surprising to me since, while I am a very political person, I tend to not post too much on Facebook because I have some of my food blog readers as followers and I don't want to go overboard. I do post the odd thing when I'm really worked up, though, and I shared Get Out the Vote items and always shared on Facebook when I donated to the campaign. So it is always clear what my views are. Anyhow, this is what I sent to her as a response. Feel free to read it on the air. Best, Christine. All right, so she sent a letter to this person who had unfriended her on Facebook because of the political content of her Facebook stream.
Letter to
Facebook unfriender. I know you're having a tough time right now. I'm very sorry about that. But I still need to say this because your message really upset me. I felt nauseous ever since. And the person I was friends with before would have wanted me to be honest with her and not handle her with kid gloves. If I'm wrong, then just delete this without reading it. I would like you to understand that I live in a place where my views are in the minority. I feel stifled and like I need to filter everything all the time. And we have tons of listeners who are in this situation.
Yes, we do.
The little blue dot in the Red Sea. We have lots and lots of readers who write to us and email us and say, you help me stay sane.
Yeah.
I am surrounded. It's terrible. And so, believe me, Christine, you are not alone. I also felt a lot of hatred over the last little while on Facebook and elsewhere. I had tears in my eyes on the way home from my son's school because of a slew of signs on the boulevard. But when my son said to me, Mommy, why do they want to put a fire on President Obama? The tears dripped down my cheeks. I wanted to go take down those Fire Obama signs, but my husband said to leave them, and if they're still there in a day or so, to call the county and ask them to be removed from the public land. They were gone the next day, and then they were back again the day after that. A backwards swastika was drawn on a large Obama sign on the side of the highway nearby. I'm not sure why it was backwards. I got the point anyways. When I walk through my neighborhood, it is all Romney signs. Every second house, not a single Obama sign, not one. A man came to my door last week, a neighbor. He rang the bell just to say thank you for putting up our Obama sign because it made him and his wife feel less alone. Yes, that's how it feels. Alone enough to go knock on a stranger's door to say thank you when you realize that you're not the only one. And again, I say we get a lot of letters like this. I'm not accusing you, and she's writing to the Facebook unfriender, I'm not accusing you of hatred. I just want you to know that I can't unfriend the place I live in. It's on the bumper stickers in front of me wherever I go, that one about drilling through a polar bear's ass to get cheaper gas. A guy with that one must live on my block because I see it at least once every 2 weeks. Facebook, where many of my geographically distant left-wing friends are, is a place where I can say the odd thing and know that at least someone will support it. I certainly never thought I was being hateful. I did have one snarky comment about Google Autofill and Paul Ryan. I felt bad about it afterwards, but was really angry at the time about the idea of the poor being used as a photo prop. I hope that explains why I post political things when I do. And now, why unfriending me bothers me on a more abstract level. It makes me sad that smart people could just tune out their friends because they have different views than their own. Maybe I'm misreading this and you meant that you're unfriending everyone political. If so, I apologize for the following in advance. I honestly think that one of the problems in our world right now is that we don't like listening to things we don't want to hear. We don't want to talk and debate, and we don't even want to hear anything that goes against what we believe. A whole media industry has bloomed where people can tune into only the news reports that will say things that confirm their ideas.
Uh-huh.
Flipping from one channel to the other, you would often not even know that they were reporting about the same event. That's how different they can be. What would happen to our world if everyone only listened to those who confirm what they already think? It's scary. Finally, I know that one of your biggest issues is being pro-life. I don't think I've ever talked about abortion on Facebook. I've always meant to say the following to you, but the conversation never came up. I, like many liberals, wish and hope that abortions do not happen. I would prefer to live in a world where they don't. But the way I think this is best achieved is through access to contraception, support of mothers and children in terms of health care and nutrition, and through education, education, education. Education about contraception, education about what it means to be sexual, education about respect and knowing the consequences of your actions, how hard it is to raise babies, education about incest and rape awareness, and prevention. I would love to live in a world where nobody even considers having an abortion, where it just isn't needed because unwanted and unplanned pregnancies just don't happen. That is what I think our society should be striving towards. And so I think we agree, sort of. In a way, I am pro-life. But until we get to that ideal place, I believe that it is better to give women a safe and clean way to make their choice than to leave them suffering, scared, and possibly fatally wounded. I know you said that we can be friends in real life, but just not on Facebook. I'm sorry to say that I don't think I can be real-life friends with someone who will just shut me up when I say something they disagree with. I'm sorry. That's all. This is just a tremendously moving letter. And I wanted to say we got a good letter from another listener who reminded me not to use the term pro-life because they're not. And so, you know, the anti-choice movement or the anti-abortion movement is even more accurate than pro-life. But, you know, she's making a distinction between that really there is a lot of common ground between her and her friend. I'm going to be really interested on that abortion thing, not to get too far off the mark, but if Obamacare reduces the abortion rates as much as it predicts that it will, it's going to be about fundraising, you know, and these fundraising organizations, a lot of them spend 85% of their money on administration costs. And I mean, they're not spending money on reducing abortions because it's a cash cow for the Republican Party. So,
Well,
I'm going to be really interested to see it. And I'm going to shout from the rooftops when the abortion rate goes down as a result of people having access to contraception. I think that's
it won't change their minds at all.
No. And this is a letter about a personal relationship. She is face to face friends with this person or was.
Uh-huh.
And some of it is, and she probably does need to actually talk to this person about why they unfriended her from the standpoint of did they unfriend everyone that was doing anything political because they just didn't want to deal with it, in which case that's sort of just the cowardly thing. And there are a lot of people out there that just don't want to talk about politics because they're terrified of conflict.
Yes.
And they're terrified of appearing stupid. And they're really not interested in politics or they're afraid to be interested in politics. And so that becomes an issue with someone who does something political
at all.
Yeah.
You know, as if being pro evolution shows some sort of confirmation, liberal confirmation bias.
Yeah, or pro education
shows
that you must be a liberal if you want to educate your kids. No, I don't think that. I don't think that at all. So it would be good for Christine to try to find out from her face-to-face friend, did you unfriend everybody who was doing politics because it's an election year and you really wanted it turned off? Or was it just me?
Well, something I said. And I think there's an important distinction here, and I think her letter gets at it, which is the difference between politics and stuff I don't like.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's a whole school of thought about why gay marriage is so it is inexplicable from a ideological standpoint, from a philosophical standpoint. If you're a conservative, you should be pro-gay marriage.
Yeah.
If you're a liberal, this is not a liberal conservative issue. You know, from a small government, leave people alone, let them do what they want point of view, conservatives naturally should have a school of thought that says, and there's a small group of people who do that. But there's a much, much, much larger group of people called the Republican Party who don't believe that. But what it gets down to is, you know, the idea of two guys having sex is icky, and I don't want to think
about
it.
Well, and having an abortion is icky, too. Yeah.
And, you know, black people dating white people and marrying them is icky, and I don't want to think about that. So I'm going to invent a theology that says that that's against God's will or bad for the country or whatever. And I'm going to promulgate that as – and if you push back against that, then you're being political.
Yep.
And the person in the middle who just doesn't want to hear it anymore eventually has to – you know, eventually Edith Bunker has to take a side.
Exactly. And that's what happened with all of this rape talk during the election. These guys thought that they were helping themselves, and what they were doing was politicizing everyone in the world that has had sex with a woman or has had a daughter or has had a mother or whatever, you know, had any experience with another woman in terms of friendship, relationship, whatever, to say, oh, wait, you know, when someone is raped, we don't talk about whether it's actual forcible rape or is it pretend dating rape, which is really just, you know, the guy paid for dinner, let's face it. You know, and you get into this, that politicizes people.
And at some point, again, as a metaphor I've used before, this is the tribe of people who rub shit in their hair and don't realize that it looks ridiculous and smells awful and makes them look monstrous. And they're in a club of people, all of whom rub shit in their hair. Yeah. And then one day they walk out in public and can't figure out why everyone is screaming and running away from them.
Yeah.
Because this is what God, because they've invented some little story about how God wants them to rub shit in their hair.
Yeah.
And they build a whole political school about the shit in the hair and why God wants that to be true.
Well, and I think something that's so important too is some very powerful, and I hate to say it, but some very powerful white men have figured out how to make a buck off of those people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when that happens, they will feed those shit hair people everything they want for money forever.
And that's why at some point when just from a practical point of view, I've had a little experience, a little bit of this happen on the liberal side too, which is when I have proposed what I consider to be very reasonable public policy ideas that are not magic bullets or anything, but it's like, can we at least agree that no, fuck you. The whole system has to be brought down, crashed and burned, and then we can start over. Anything else is just fantasy land. These are, you know, expatriate Nader voters who will not accept that there is a difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. However small it might be, however much you might be disappointed, there's an actual difference. No, there's not. They're both the same. They're both exactly the same, and everything has to be crashed to the ground and destroyed and burned. And then we can rebuild a model society, which is exactly what, you know, Bolsheviks say. let's start over again is incredibly cruel and childish when you consider the number, the millions, hundreds of millions of people who are going to die.
Yeah.
If you crash the system, fuck them. You know, better to have a pure world of it. And so I kind of get that. They're in nowhere near the same numbers. They have nowhere near the same influence. But I get the mindset. But at some point, I just count their tree rings. You have decided this is where you've gone all in with whatever your opinion is. And the idea that I'm going to change your mind is pointless. So I just move on to the next thing. But I have noticed a theme in our show, Blue Gal, other than me blabbing and riffing and deciding. We are all trying to find a way to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And we're trying to find a way to feed back to each other, to get past people's bumper stickers and get past and get and finding out there's nothing beyond the bumper sticker. The only thing in their head is a bunch of Romney signs. There's nothing else there. There's nobody to reach.
Yeah.
And there's some people who are terrified of politics. And there's some people who you the audience William was talking about to argue against. And that is probably my greatest source. If you took that collectively, and we're going to move on to a couple letters, my greatest source of anger and frustration with our media. If you read Chris Hayes's Twilight of the Elites, he talks about networks, money, and platforms. And networks are all of your rich friends. So it doesn't matter how badly you fuck up, they will prop you back up again. And money is you buy your way into networks of influence. So there's this incestuous relationship between money and networks and money and who you know and how much you have. And you'll always be rich if you're in the club. And the only way to cut through that, the only way to actually get in the door to advocate for poor people and people who don't have political power or money is media. Mm-hmm. The only way to do it, the only way to get their attention is by highly focusing on people who are conducting our public conversations and who are controlling our public conversations and who are influencing those things. And the thing that drives me crazy is that the people who are most influential in that third domain, in deciding the frame of the debate and then insisting that we conduct all debate within these four walls, are the very people who will not engage in conversation, who will absolutely not admit they're wrong, will absolutely not stand still to be confronted in a public sphere, who will absolutely protect themselves from their own failures and incompetence and just keep rolling right along. And that's what drives me crazy, because the only space we have to talk to each other is, on a broad scale, is the media, however you want to define that. And once you've killed that by filling it up with people who write silly things about deficits and crazy things about the Iraq war and stupid things about the leadership skills of George W. Bush and the bright, bright future of the Republican Party.
And in every conversation these days, sneak in the words entitlement reform.
And both
so
sides.
So that by the end of the month, entitlement reform is just a thing. It's the Cokie Roberts syndrome. It's out
there. Grand bargain,
we've been
honey.
Doing a grand bargain. We've been we're done. We know this is going to happen. We've been talking about it for weeks and weeks. And I'm calling people out on Twitter who do that by name and linking them and saying, don't sneak those words into your conversation and think we don't get it. What
because
you're trying to do.
We poor sort of broke pariahs on the left cannot outspend Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah.
We cannot out-network Robert Gibbs or Newt Gingrich or people who have just an incredible array of a Rolodex that's solid gold, who will always publish your book, who will always put you on the air, who will not even think twice about making sure that no matter how badly you screw up, you are always salvaged and brushed off and put right again, who will invite you to the Aspen Ideas Festival. Who will capitalize your business. We can't compete in those worlds. The only place we can compete, the only place we have any hope of getting our ideas back into the public square is where you actually have a debate over ideas.
Are you saying Facebook?
Possibly.
Yeah.
But Facebook is one venue which the downsides of which are too high for me.
Yeah.
And the upsides are, transient. But the only place we have an entry point is where you can have an honest face-to-face, toe-to-toe confrontation over facts and ideas. Mm-hmm. And that is the reason why liberals are not allowed on television and barely allowed on the radio.
Yep.
Because if
why
you
we
put
have to be the media.
Yeah. Well, if you put you or me toe-to-toe with David Brooks or Cokie Roberts or Mark Halperin or go down the list, we could crush them in about 5 minutes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And that's why we're never going to be allowed anywhere near those people, because they are they're holding this fragile monopoly on the imposition of their opinions on the public debate. But that's really the only venue we have left. And that's why we fight for it so hard and are to the point of being, redundant. Yeah. Sorry about that.
No,
anyway,
okay.
But it's all about how we have our conversations and how we get things talked about to people who don't want to listen to us or who are recalcitrant and isn't even worth our time. So I'm very glad our letter writers have put us on that track. And
I am too. And also, you know, it is about building relationships. And sometimes you're going to be in a situation where you build relationships with someone, thank God, who's on a different political track than you.
Yeah.
And I think you and I are both sad because the Fox News talking spew of lies means that the person that might be on a different track for you isn't dealing in facts. And you can't learn something from you. I find that my wall goes up because it's gone on for so long that I feel like I can't learn something from those people.
Yep.
And
yep.
I don't like myself when that wall goes up. I want to be able to listen to someone, hear what they have to say. But if it's, you know, Target is owned by the French.
Boom.
The wall comes down. I don't have time for that.
Wasn't there a Steve Martin bit about one of the advantages of getting older is you get to be prejudiced?
Yeah, and you can say, I hate camping.
I hate camping. Let's go camping. No. You know, I've already done that. I don't like it.
Yeah.
And there's a certain kind of, and it certainly has crept into my conversation and thinking, where if I hear someone, you see those flags go up of, oh, you know, people who make up bullshit stories about unemployment or make up bullshit stories about Iraq. Or make up bullshit.
Yeah.
Pardon me? I just shut the door. I go, oh, you're the property of Roger Ailes.
Yeah.
Roger Ailes owns your ass. And there's no point in me trying to persuade you because the downside for you to start admitting that you're wrong is so catastrophic.
Yeah.
Is so, you know, the amount of self-loathing.
When
you'll
I'm
have
in
to
a situation, I do have to say I do have an ace up my sleeve a lot of the time, because when I'm in a meeting with people and they know me and my kids, and they know my kids come to church well dressed, and that I'm a good mom, and I'm really involved in their education, and I'm well educated and well spoken, and on and on and on. And they start bitching about poor people, and I say, well, you know, back when I was on food stamps.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. You know, and I have had people say to me, but you deserved it. Oh, boy. Don't get me started.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, there are deserving poor and undeserving poor. It's hard to be poor.
And
who doesn't deserve to feed their kids? Tell me who doesn't deserve that. You know, so.
And I have my own unfair advantage. My unfair advantage is I look like a narc. And
yes, you do.
I throw on a suit and I could be in any boardroom in America. You would not know I was a filthy liberal.
You're a middle-aged white
fast.
Guy.
You
must watch Hannity.
And I have been working for a living since I was about 17.
Yeah.
And the only reason
you're that guy
working,
who thinks Hannity might have gone too far last night. Just
he might have gone a little too far. You know.
Well,
you know. I'm not sure I agree with everything
here. I watch Hannity and then I watch Papa Bear. You know. Get both sides.
I have been working since I was a teenager. I have been supporting myself since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I have done, and I'm, this is a different conversation for a different day, but I'm the ideal Romney voter.
Absolutely. We've talked about this before too.
I got crushed in the Great Recession. I got, you know, my life savings evaporated. I had to sell my condo. I have a lovely wife and a happy family. And I love who I'm with and I love where I'm at. But from a strictly economic point of view, I have fallen from a great height onto pointy rocks.
Mm-hmm.
And so mine is the story of lots of other middle-aged white guys.
Yeah.
Except – so that gets me into a conversation. Like, no, I work for a living. I've done a lot of jobs. I've been up. I've been down. I've been laid off. I take unemployment very reluctantly, and I look for work like crazy. And when I can – the minute I can get off of it, I do. And for a long, long time, I, you know, they just worked, and that's gone now.
Yeah.
And yet I'm this liberal.
That's
inexplicable. How can that possibly be true? So it's a little bit unfair, but you know what? I do tell people, and this is true, I'm a typical liberal.
Yes, you are. That's really the point.
I am the typical liberal.
Absolutely.
And the reason you don't know about me is because the people you listen to lie to you constantly. And I don't know why you're okay with that.
And those people, bless their hearts, who are union members.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm a typical union member.
Yeah.
Michelle Malkin will tell you otherwise all the time that I'm a thug. But no, I'm not speaking for myself, but if you're in a union, you know, if you can say to people, you know, I'm a mom and I take care about my school and I care about my family and I'm trying to feed my family and have a middle class life. It just broke my heart last week on Chris Hayes when that woman from the Demos Foundation said that the American dream is getting out of debt.
Yeah.
And yeah. I just thought, oh my, when somebody speaks some sort of essential core truth that's true about everybody you know.
Catches you like a right cross.
Yeah.
I've never heard it put that way. Damn, he's exactly right.
Yep.
The American dream is now trying to get out of debt.
Trying to get out of debt. Yeah. So, you know, this is something that can unite you with your neighbors.
Yes.
I wanted to make sure I got that out. Okay, we have some quick emails from people.
Yeah.
Why don't you just mention what Steve wrote us, and I wanted to make sure we mentioned this.
Steve wrote via email, "You mentioned Beltway thinking circa 1952, which made me wonder about the place of my birth. Was there a Beltway in 1952? No. Construction started in 1957 and was completed in 1964.
So and you know what? There was no Beltway. You
know,
yeah.
You know what happened in 1964? Lyndon Johnson destroyed the Democratic Party. And drove all of those nice white people.
Southerners out because of economic freedom.
So there you go. And the minute the exodus of the white man to the Republican Party, to the transformation of the party of Lincoln to the party of Jefferson Davis, began at the moment the Beltway was done being constructed.
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, it is.
Suck on that, historians. All right.
We had someone write to us who goes by the handle K. Freed. And he reminded us that nearly all the Republicans who won congressional races in 2010 and 2012 are theocrats. Yep. And, you know, I'm the one who helps to put together Blog Against Theocracy over Easter weekend. And that is still a very, very big issue. The theocracy and people are talking now a lot about global warming and the connection between the religious right and the oil companies and that kind of marriage that's really weird. I'm not sure how many boots on the ground Christians really want to support the oil companies undeniably, but if you are a biblical fundamentalist who must believe that the earth is 6,000 years old in order to have any faith in God, I think that was the thing that Jonathan Alter said last week that hit me. I believe it was him. About how Mother Nature will continue to remind us that the Earth is not 6,000 years old, and that
am I permitted to say my man Jonathan Alter?
Your man. You are.
He and I correspond.
That's
we swap.
Very nice. Yeah, he's a nice man. He really is.
And he liked one of my posts a lot, and
said so. That was very kind of him. Yeah, good guy. So why don't you read? Here's another quick one. Dan via email. You want to read that?
Dan via email writes, "White Christian men are in fact a minority, despite the fact that they still dominate politics, business, and the other levers of power in this country. The idea that Obama won because he had the support of, quote, minorities, is 20th century thinking in a 21st century world. We need a new way of looking and speaking about our population. Now, I have nothing against white Christian men. Many of my best friends and my father-in-law is practicing, and my stepfather is one ethnically, are white Christian men. But the idea that it's normal for rule by white Christian men is a 20th and 19th and 18th century idea."
Yeah, and this goes right against what Bill O'Reilly was saying about traditional America is no more. America. And traditional America is white patriarchy. That's what he's talking about.
Well, And here's, you know, the magic trick of America that was always supposed to be true, and yet every time the dominant ethnic group is challenged, they become blood and soil Americans.
Yeah.
No, America's about a patch of land and the blood we spilled for it.
Mm-hmm.
No, America is an idea.
Yeah.
And it's the whole trick is that if you buy the idea and you buy the concept of democracy, representative democracy, personal initiative, social contract, the whole stew of things that America has become, then you're an American. You don't have to be any particular background. You have to have any race, color, creed, gender, doesn't matter. You get to be an American if you accept the idea of America, right up until you become the top of the heap. And then it becomes really important that you enforce an orthodoxy over what people should look like and the language they should speak and where they should come from and how they should practice their religion or the lack of religion. To the extent – and that becomes – you become so obsessed with that that you begin rewriting American history.
Mm-hmm.
You make Thomas Jefferson into a fundamentalist Christian.
Yeah, right.
You put Jesus on the horseback with Paul Revere, which he wasn't. And that's where you destroy the idea of America by becoming a hierarchy based on birth, privilege, skin color, religion, or whatever. And so Bill O'Reilly, in the most profound way possible, betrays every idea of America by his obsession with the real America's dead.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Bill O'Reilly. I said the F word. I promised I wouldn't do that the entire show, and there I did destroy the entire thing. We'll have to retape. We're at an hour and 6 minutes. We'll have to retape the entire thing. Sorry. They're doing this on a reel-to-reel recorder.
I have to clip it with little pinking shears. Yeah.
A razor blade, and we'll splice it. It'll be great. Don't worry about it.
Well, thank you, everyone. And every week we feature at our website and Facebook page an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is the marvelous hunter, Mr. Cat. And Mr. Cat is a handsome tomcat. Very handsome, very attractive. And you can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. Be aware that if you write us at any address, we reserve the right to read your email on the air unless you say otherwise. But we do just love hearing from you.
We do.
So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Blue Gal, the Internet Kitties are so grateful for the Internet and the turkey and the presidential election results and our listeners. So, thank you.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
This podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2012, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
David Brooks, in February of 2002, would like America to know that President Bush has broken the libertarian grip on the GOP.
Thank God!